From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jazz Week continues with Woody Herman. We'll hear a 1986 interview with the late clarinetist, singer, and bandleader, who was known for featuring great arrangers and soloists. One of the great soloists who emerged from the band was tenor saxophonist Stan Getz. We'll listen back to an interview with Getz recorded 1 year before his death. We'll also hear from singer Anita O'Day. And we'll remember Jason Robards, the Academy Award-winning actor, died yesterday at the age of 78. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today, President Clinton said Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak has accepted ideas presented by the United States as a basis for continued peace negotiations with the Palestinians. The president urged PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat to accept them as well. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Mr. Clinton presented the ideas for resolving the conflict to Israeli and Palestinian negotiators on Saturday after they had completed 5 days of talks in Washington. The president told reporters in the Oval Office that Prime Minister Barak says he'd accept the ideas if the Palestinians would.
The issues are extremely difficult, but they are closer than they have ever been before, and I hope and pray they will seize this opportunity.
The president's ideas would reportedly give Palestinians more control over East Jerusalem, which was captured by Israel in 1967. But in exchange, Palestinian refugees and their descendants would have to give up the right to return to the homes they fled inside Israel in 1948. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
People in the south-central part of the country are still coping with the effects of this week's storm. The storm left a crust of ice that snapped tree limbs and power lines, leaving hundreds of thousands of people without electricity. Jim Daly, the mayor of Little Rock, Arkansas, detailed some of his area's problems.
Power outages, tree limbs falling, power poles that literally just break in half under the weight of the power lines with a three-quarters of an inch or so of ice on them, trees that are uprooted and falling across streets.
The storm left more than 200,000 people without power in Arkansas. California's Governor Gray Davis discussed the state's electric power crisis with President Clinton today. The Energy Department has extended its order for energy producers to keep selling power to California utilities until January 9th. Rachel Myro reports from member station KPCC.
Before Energy Secretary Bill Richardson's emergency order, California faced rolling blackouts. Regional power suppliers wouldn't sell to the state's two biggest utilities for fear they couldn't pay the going rates. Federal regulators have since imposed a soft price cap to steady the market, but Governor Gray Davis, speaking outside the White House, again accused power generators of price gouging at a time when the state is most vulnerable.
Deregulation works when you have genuine price competition. That only works when you have some rough balance between supply and demand, which we do not have and will not have for at least 2 years.
During his two-day trip to Washington, Davis also met with Federal Reserve Chief Alan Greenspan and Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers, seeking, he said, their advice and guidance. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Myro in Los Angeles.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 110 points, or 1%. It closed at 10,803. This is NPR News. The man accused of killing seven co-workers at a computer consulting firm in Massachusetts has been locked up without bail. Prosecutors said Michael McDermott had hidden guns and ammunition in his workspace, and police say they found bomb-making material in his home. At his arraignment today, prosecutors said the 42-year-old suspect methodically killed four women and three men at the Edgewater Technology Company near Boston. They said he may have been angry that the company was planning to obey an IRS order to garnish his wages for back taxes. A man who was stranded in his snow-buried car for 16 days in Central Oregon has been released from the hospital. He's now in the custody of the Air Force. Colin Fogarty reports from Oregon Public Broadcasting.
On December 23rd, a group of snowmobilers riding through the Deschutes National Forest spotted a backpack by the side of the path. That led them to a sports car buried in 5 feet of snow. Inside, 29-year-old Thomas Wade Pruitt had been stranded for more than 2 weeks, surviving on orange juice, a little water, and a package of almond M&Ms. He lost 20 pounds. Pruitt had written a note saying goodbye to his parents in Florida. After being rescued, Pruitt was flown to St. Charles Medical Center in Bend, where he's being treated for hypothermia. But his ordeal is not over. When he's released from the hospital, he'll be taken back to Ellsworth Air Force Base in Rapid City, South Dakota. Pruitt allegedly fled the base on December 3rd. For NPR News, I'm Colin Fogarty in Portland, Oregon.
The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 46 points today. It closed at 2539. This is NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, saluting cultural programming on NPR, the recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal for the Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Jazz Week on our show. We're featuring interviews from our archive with musicians and singers who have made significant contributions to the history of jazz. Woody Herman was a clarinetist, saxophone player, and singer. Perhaps his greatest achievement was as a band leader, directing innovative soloists and arrangers. A little later, we'll hear from Stan Getz, who got his start in Herman's band. First, let's hear one of Herman's recordings from the mid-40s. Here he is singing, "I Told You I Love You, Now Get Out."
I told you I love you, now get out. I told you I love you, now get out. Everything's rosy and everything's Jake, but just how much can a good man take? I told you I love you, now get out. There may be times when I need you, there's no doubt. Baby, now you're something I can do without. Leave your number and go on home, but don't wait with sandwiches by the phone. I told you I love you, now get out.
Woody Herman organized his first band in 1937 during the height of the big band era and kept together his band, the Thundering Herd, long after that era ended. He stayed on the road until failing health made travel impossible. Herman died of congestive heart failure, emphysema, and pneumonia in 1987 at the age of 74. I spoke with him in 1986 when he was still on the road.
There's a lot of musicians that really got started in your band, and just to tick off a few, Stan Getz, Al Cohn, Zoot Sims, Jimmy Giuffre.
Right. The Four Brothers still were some of the people that later came on the scene.
What do you look for? How do you audition someone? Let's start with the 30s and 40s. How did you then go about finding people?
Then it was really less difficult if there was somebody that you really liked. And if they were working for someone else, you try to get them to join your band because you were trying to play new things and probably more musical things. And those that wanted to progress joined us. And I think that was a big come on as far as guys were concerned.
The band that you led in the 30s and the early 40s, you described as a cooperative band that was an offshoot of the Isham Jones band. What was the first band that you really thought of as being yours?
Well, let me tell you why that band was changed. And there was a different kind of evolution took place, but it was because of wartime. And as people were drafted out and went into the service, we had to get different kind of people or new people or people who we thought would work for us. And then I decided that it was now my sole responsibility and I wanted to do more progressive music than we were doing in the earliest days. And I wanted to improve. I wanted the band to improve and be one that could play all kinds of music and do it well.
Another thing that made that band unique was that it was a big band that was playing harmonies and rhythms that came out of bop. And I think a lot of the big bands really were resisting
that. They weren't
that
interested, and I was. So, as a matter of fact, our whole band, shortly before we went into the second herd, if you want to call it that, the Four Brothers herd, I insisted that our whole band that we would go to hear Charlie Parker at his opening on 52nd Street with Dizzy and a few of our friends, because Dizzy was already writing for our band.
Was it hard to figure out how to incorporate the rhythmic and harmonic innovations of bop into a big band setting?
Well, I think you had to have imagination, and I think that you... in other words, there's two kinds of music, as Ellington said many times, and certainly Stravinsky said it to me personally. Two kinds of music, good and bad, and we were definitely trying to play good.
Second Herd, which was your second band, you organized that in 46 or 47.
47.
And this was just about the time that a lot of the big bands were
starting to
fold.
That's when they all disappeared, yeah.
Yeah, so you were really going against the tide then by organizing a big band.
Yeah. Well, everybody left except Ellington, Basie, and maybe Harry James. And everyone else just took a run for it, and mostly. And...
was it hard to keep the bands going? Is that why so many of them disappeared?
Yeah, well, financially it was a bust. It was no longer a business. It was now a hobby, and if you could afford it, you did it.
How were you able to do it?
Because I made it a hobby. And I've suffered the consequences ever since, you know. I got into trouble later with the IRS, and I'm still in trouble with them at this late date.
You once said that what would have made the best financial sense would have been after 1946 or so to take your money and invest it, not invest it in a band, invest it.
Yeah, oh, of course, yeah.
But obviously you've put music first.
Well, it's been above everything in my lifetime, so sometimes it's been a disservice to me as a person, but that's beside the point, because I still have that love and affection for music. And I'm still alive, I think, because of my love for music. And the Lord has been kind to me. Let's look at it that way.
Woody Herman recorded in 1986, 1 year before his death. Stan Getz was first noticed when he played with the Woody Herman Band and was part of the saxophone section known as the Four Brothers. He's on this Herman Band ballad called Early Autumn. Jazz critic Francis Davis described tenor saxophonist Stan Getz as one of the most lyrical soloists in jazz. Thanks to his melodic gift, Getz joined Miles Davis as the only two jazz instrumentalists of their generation to catch the ear of the general public without sacrificing the respect of serious jazz audiences. Getz has rightly been credited with popularizing bossa nova with his hit recordings of Desafinado and The Girl from Ipanema. In 1949, he became a star as a result of this solo on Early Autumn. I spoke with Stan Getz in June of 1990, 1 year before his death at the age of 64 of cancer. I asked him about playing in the legendary saxophone section of the Woody Herman Band. The saxophone section became known as the Four Brothers.
Correct. Well, it wasn't originally titled the Four Brothers. It was titled the Four Mothers.
Oh, really? Got it.
But we couldn't use it that way at the time, so it became Brothers. But now you could say Four Mothers.
Uh-huh. Well, what was it like for you being in such a great section? You know, I don't know how many bands have such a good horn section.
It was a great band. I mean, it's been one thrill after another in this business with the musicians I've played with and the places I've been. Keeps you young.
It was in the early 1950s, I think, that you went out on your own, started your own band. Was it a big responsibility when you were younger to have bands on your own and have to worry about, you know, paying the musicians in the bands when you were on gigs and stuff like that?
It was. I was totally unprepared and ill-equipped for it. But because I had a chance to play with whom I wanted to in the rhythm section, in rhythm sections, and to play the music I wanted to exactly as the way I wanted to, it was a great thrill. So the lack of money meant nothing. We just made it somehow, and we kept going on and on.
Let me play one of your early recordings with your own group. This is a 1952 session of Body and Soul. And playing with you is Duke Jordan at the piano, Jimmy Rainey guitar, Bill Crow bass, and Frank Asola drums. This is Body and Soul, recorded in 1952. Body and Soul, my guest Stan Getz on tenor saxophone. Do you have good memories of this session?
Yeah, I do. It was my first session for the Verve label. First time I met Norman Granz, and that started a 20-year relationship with the Verve, which was bought by Polygram, and now they still put it out under the Verve name. I have 80 records on that label.
A lot of musicians in the 1950s ended up getting hooked on heroin. And from what I've heard, one of the things I've heard from a lot of musicians is that they saw the musicians they looked up to doing drugs and ended up doing them themselves, and partially in an attempt to emulate their heroes and also thinking that maybe they'd sound better. And I know you had a drug problem in your teens and in part of your 20s. And I was wondering how you got involved with that.
You know, I think as I look back on it, that musicians use drugs and alcohol for two reasons. One of the reasons is the same reason as why doctors have used morphine. Because when you get tired, morphine is a work drug. As long as you don't take too much of it, it'll keep you going. Alcohol is a temporary stimulant before it's a depressant. I think that was one reason, because we traveled and worked very hard, and it was there. I didn't look to any idols for the reason why I would take drugs so it would make me play better. That's nonsense. The other reason is that there's a state of mind that you need to do anything in the art forms. It's called the alpha state. Delta is pure sleep. That's another state, brain waves. And there's delta, there's theta, which is meditation. And alpha is the one state of mind that you do to go into creating something. It's sort of like thinking off the top of your head, relaxed concentration. And when you can't get that naturally, if you're too tired or something, you might resort to alcohol, drugs, to chocolate, to food, anything that will give you a chance to get into alpha, to relax and think, but not really think like, say, an accountant would think, but think in the artistic sense of the word. That's the reason I use stuff.
You ended up in prison for a while. How were you busted?
I had needle marks on my arm, which is a law that since has been declared unconstitutional. It was a misdemeanor, first offense, but it seems that the judge's son had gotten into the same trouble and he was angry. And he gave me 180 days hard time, first offense on a misdemeanor, and 3 years probation. So all for the best, I think. No pain, no gain in this life.
So you were in prison just for having needle marks?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of prison were you in?
The L.A. holding jail, L.A. County Jail. That's the kind of jail where it's not an institution. It's where people who can't make bail rot in the cell.
Is that what you felt you were doing, is rotting in the cell?
Of course I was. That's what we were all doing. And it was an overcrowded jail.
Did you have to kick in jail?
Yeah.
What'd you do when you got out?
What I do, I played and was very happy. I played music 4 days after I got out. After not touching my horn, they took it away in jail. I played a concert at the Shrine Auditorium for 7,000 people.
We'll hear more of our 1990 interview with Stan Getz after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's Jazz Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1990 interview with tenor saxophonist Stan Getz.
You were the musician in the 60s most responsible for popularizing Brazilian music in the United States, especially, your albums with Wild Gilberto and work with Carlos Jobim. The biggest hit, I think, was Girl from Ipanema. What got you interested in Brazilian music?
The beauty of it.
Had you traveled down there?
Never been to Brazil when I made those records. A lot of people think I'm Brazilian.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm from North Brazil, the Bronx. No, it's just beautiful music with very, very suggestive, laid-back rhythms. And the melodies are beautiful and sad and romantic. It's a folk music. All folk music is beautiful. And it goes perfectly with jazz. So, there you are.
Well, let me play what was probably your biggest bossa nova hit, The Girl from Ipanema, probably the single record that had the biggest effect on Americans in the 60s in terms of Brazilian music.
Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, he smiles, but she doesn't.
Stan Getz and his version of Girl from Ipanema. And when you ended up on the pop charts, were you surprised?
Oh, was I ever. I recorded the music because I thought it was beautiful, and here it turns out to be commercially very viable. And I was amazed.
How do you think your sound has changed over the years?
It's gotten gutsier. It's more direct. It isn't as pretty It's not as feminine.
What do you mean by feminine?
Oh, sort of light, airy, feminine, effeminate, or it just, it has more substance, and it's more direct.
How did you start playing in the upper register a lot?
I think I played the lead tenor part with Woody Herman's band.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was up above everybody else, and I sort of got used to it. And I think then when I got a quartet, too, we used to play in noisy clubs, people drinking, and I'd have to play in the upper register, it seems, to be heard as a lead voice with over a rhythm section. And then again, maybe I just like it. I don't play nearly as much in the upper register as I used to.
Mm-hmm. Most of your life, you've been on and off the road, touring, traveling. How do you like life on the road?
Physically and emotionally, it can be wearing. But there's one thing that makes it all worthwhile, and that's that you do get up to play music in different towns for different people. So all the inconvenience you put up with is canceled out by that one main thing, the reason why you're there.
Mm-hmm. You have a family. You have married.
Well,
you have
they're
several
all grown
children.
Now.
Yeah, but when you were younger, was it hard to leave the family and go on the road?
Oh, my family life probably suffered from it, I'm sure. What could I do? It seems my life has been music. And the constant search for it is in some ways been the mainspring of my life. What can I do?
Stan Getz recorded in 1990. He died 1 year later of cancer. Our Jazz Week series continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Nonesuch Records, featuring Red Dirt Girl, the new album by Emmylou Harris, available in record stores. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Everyday Genius by Michael J. Gelb, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jazz Week continues with singer Anita O'Day. And we remember Jason Robards. He died yesterday at the age of 78.
Here I go again. I hear those trumpets blow again. All aglow again. Taking a chance on love. Here I slide again. About to take that ride again. Starry-eyed again. Taking a chance on love. I thought the cards were a frame-up. I never would try. But now I'm taking the game up. And the ace of hearts is high. Things are mending now. I see a rainbow blending now. We'll have a happy ending now. Taking a chance on love. I'm taking a chance on love.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our Jazz Week continues with Anita O'Day. She first became known in 1941 when she joined the Gene Krupa Band. She later sang with Stan Kenton and Benny Goodman and many small groups. Here's her 1960 recording of That Old Feeling.
I saw you last night and got that old feeling. When you came in sight, I got that old feeling. The moment that you danced by, I felt a thrill. And when you caught my eye, my heart stood still. Once again, I seem to feel that old yearning. And I knew the spark of love was still burning. There'll be no new romance for me. It's foolish to start. For that old feeling is still in my heart. I saw you last night, got that old feeling when you came.
In her 1981 autobiography, High Times, Hard Times, Anita O'Day explained that her last name was Colton, but she changed it to O'Day because in Pig Latin that means dough, and she hoped to make plenty of it. Unfortunately, most of the money she did make from her records and concerts went into her arm. She had always been a hard drinker, but in 1954, she started using heroin. It wasn't until 15 years later that she kicked the habit. I spoke with her in 1987 when she was 68. Throughout your career, you've always not wanted to be the, quote, girl singer, the person who's accompanied by the band, accompanied by the orchestra. You've always said you wanted your voice to be part of the band.
Right.
Would you explain some of the things that you did and didn't want as a singer with a band?
Well, the things I did want was to be there because you learn and you earn while you learn. Nothing wrong with that one. The band work is really very simple work. It's called pattern work. And you mostly sing quarter notes, and the band fills with patterns. Pleasure, you're about. The band goes, do-wah. You know what I'm talking about?
Uh-huh.
So it's called pattern work. And then, after Gene Krupa Orchestra for 5 years and Stan Kenton for 1 year, this is a few years back, I decided that I would like to try for a small group, which is different kind of work. You make the fills yourself. It's called improvising, and that's good jazz. And that's what I'm doing at Kimball's for the next 4 days.
When you were singing with big bands, you were usually the only woman in the band. And I think it was always a source of pride for you that you could, you know, keep up with the men in every way. In your book, you wrote that you were proud that you carried your own bags, you paid your own checks when you were with the Krupa Band.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, I sort of became one of the guys because that was the only way to play it, you know? I mean, I guess you could play it girl, but I haven't played girl yet. Let's see, I'm 68. I'm going to play girl next year because I'm always too busy.
What does playing girl mean to you?
Just that. You know, you wear girls' clothes and you don't pick up your own bags. I've been wearing slacks since 1932.
Well, actually, you mentioned in your autobiography that because you sometimes, when you were on the road, wore a real simple outfit, a band jacket and just a simple skirt, that some people figured you must be a lesbian because you weren't wearing a gown.
Well, how about I was wearing the jacket of the band, and the skirt idea was like an idea I had, and Gene went for it, you know? The next thing you know, the modern eras were doing the same thing. It's a matter of convenience, which is what life is all about, where I work it is.
Your first big break was when you joined Gene Krupa's band. What's the story about how you joined up with his band?
I was singing in a jazz club in Chicago, and it was located downtown. Gene was working in the Sherman Hotel, which is downtown, and we were open till 4. The hotel's closed around 2, and the band would come by every night. And Gene said to me one night, I never fire anybody, but if my singer Irene Day, D-A-Y-E, ever leaves, he says, I'll contact you. And about a year later, he did. Absolutely.
You used to sing duets with trumpeter Roy Eldridge. Was there any resistance at that time, and this is the early 1940s, to having a black performer and a white performer singing duets on the same stage?
Well, I think there was something going on out there. It didn't bother me. I'm from Chicago. I went to colored schools. You know, that didn't bother me. When we played the South, it was really horrendous at that time, right?
There were negative reactions from the audience or from the club owners who caused the problems?
In the South, it was just the people for him to get into the theater, let alone perform, you know. In New York City, there was no problem.
I want to play the first really big hit that you have, play an excerpt of it. This was, you recorded this in 1941 with Roy Eldridge.
With Roy, yeah, I do it every night. Yes, I call it my nostalgia portion, and I do Let Me Off Uptown.
What's the story behind the record? How did you get to do a duet on this?
Oh, I have no idea. Gene bought it from somebody who made the arrangement and taught us how to do it.
And
it belonged to Gene. It was in his books.
The record sold, I think, 1.5 million copies?
That's the one Gene bought a house in Yonkers. Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's play an excerpt of it. This is my guest Anita O'Day. It's recorded in 1941.
Right.
Hey, Joe.
What do you mean, Joe? My name's Roy.
Well, come here, Roy, and get groovy. You been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown, but I've been around.
You mean to say you ain't been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown. What's uptown?
If it's pleasure you're about, and you feel like stepping out, oh, you've got to shout it, let me off uptown. If it's rhythm that you feel, then it's nothing to conceal. Oh, you've got to spill it, let me off uptown. Rib joints, juke joints, hip joints. Where could a fella go to top it? If you want to pitch a ball and you can't afford a hall, oh, you've got to call it, let me off uptown.
Anita, oh, Anita. Say, I feel something.
What you feel, Roy? The heat?
No, it must be that uptown rhythm. I feel like blowing.
Well, blow, Roy, blow.
Anita O'Day, how did that record change your life?
Well, it didn't change it too quickly because at that time there was no union for girl singers. I made $7.50.
From 1.5 million selling record?
That's right. He built a house in Yonkers.
My goodness. Uh-huh. You played with several other big band leaders in addition to Krupa. You performed briefly with Benny Goodman, and you described him as a band leader who always tried to distract attention from the performer so that... Why, so that they wouldn't take attention away from him?
Yeah, well, that was just his style. I don't think he did it maliciously. That, you know, that was just his way.
How would he do it?
Well, for instance, if I've scheduled to do 4 tunes and the people are giving me too much attention, he would just automatically go into Sing, 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 which is his tune, and I'd have to leave the stage waving goodbye. Yeah.
You described Stan Kenton as being incapable of swinging.
Yeah, Stan couldn't swing. I mean, I love Stan, and I love his upbeats. And he was the artistry and rhythm. And that's funny, because when I was with the band, I was there for a year. I sat on the stage like the Gene Krupa Orchestra. And at the end of these extravaganzas, Stan would go, da-da-da-da, or whatever, and the band is holding this note. And he'd look over at me like, when do I cut it off, you know? If he did it on his own, he'd cut it off at 6 7/8. I never heard of it. But I'd get him to cut it off on 4. So I did that for a year, you know, just trying to be helpful.
We'll hear more of our 1987 interview with Anita O'Day after a break. This is Fresh Air.
It's Jazz Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1987 interview with Anita O'Day. You have a very unique voice, and physically one of the reasons for part of the uniqueness of your singing is that you don't have a uvula. Can you tell us about how you lost your uvula? And I should say that that's the little fleshy overhang in the back of your mouth.
That down in the back of the throat when you see the cartoons and it shows her singing and that little thing's going, la, well, that's gone. I was in the hospital for just regular bit of tonsils or something. I think I was 7 years old, and my mother said, years later, I said, you know, I want to be a singer, and I've really got a problem. I can't get any vibration going. I have to make a different type. And that's when she told me about this uvula having been, it was a slip of the knife.
During the tonsillectomy?
Sort of. Yeah, during the, tonsillectomy, right.
So
that's how that went down.
How did that change your singing?
Well, not knowing about it from 7 years old and not knowing I was going to be singing at 20 and still singing at 68 years old, it didn't make much difference because you find a way to do it, because where there's a will, you know.
I guess what I mean is, what did you do to compensate for not having it?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. You find a way.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a lot of hard drinking in your time, and you've also done a lot of drugs in your time. Do you think that your involvement with alcohol and drugs had anything to do with wanting to keep up with the men, as we were talking about before, and wanting to be as tough as they were?
That's a good question. Never thought about it that way. No, I do it because I enjoy it. You know, everybody has their things, and that's what I do. You know, I didn't want to have a family. I didn't want to sit at home. I didn't want to be a housewife and own property. And I didn't want to work in an office from 9 to 5. And so I was just out there looking to find something that I could, like, go along with, you know, and maybe contribute to the people in the world.
You started smoking grass when you were 12 or 13 years old, and that was...
It wasn't against the law then, Terry.
That's the amazing thing. You know, it's hard for me to think of a time before marijuana was illegal.
Yeah. Well, I didn't look for it. It's just the people that were going my way, that's what they were doing, you know.
There was a period of, I guess, close to 15 years when you were using heroin and still performing most of that time.
True.
Did the musicians who were users stick together and all know who each other were?
More or less, yes.
Why was it important to stick together?
Well, to see who had the newest connection. What else? Come on, Terry.
When you were convicted several times on drug charges, how difficult did that make it for you to get bookings in certain cities that had...
It helped. That's showbiz.
Seriously, it helped? I can't tell if you're kidding or not.
No, I'm not kidding. That's showbiz. It does. It helps you. They come to look at the girl that went to jail for smoking dope. I don't say that happens today because it's too popular today, and the kids grew up and they say, well, that's a scam, you know. But at that time, that was part of it. Man, I'd work a club and they'd be standing out down the street around the corner getting in to see the girl just get out of jail. Yeah.
How did you finally kick after?
Oh, I went to Hawaii. I went to Hawaii, and I didn't know anybody in Hawaii. And when you get the chills, I just laid in the hot sun. And when you get the sweats, I jumped in the water. I did it for 5 months, cool, cold, and straight ever since.
Did you have to almost relearn how to sing straight after you'd been performing high for so many years?
Yeah, you kind of have to work around it, right. That's why I went back to the nostalgia things, because I'd been doing bebop and whatever else, and so I went back to before that time, and that's what I'm doing now.
When you were straight again and ready to start performing again, how did you get the word out?
The word out?
The word out that you were straight and that you were ready to perform again.
Oh, I don't think if you're straight and ready to perform has anything to do with it. You just call an agent, and if he can find your work, you go. The people that hire you don't care if you're straight or not.
So club owners...
It's an open game. It's an open game. If you're on your feet and you want to work, you can work. These people walk around homeless and can't find a job. I don't go with that. You know, you want to work, you'll find a job.
So it just didn't matter for you when you were hooked?
I worked all the time.
Uh-huh. Did people know?
Everybody knew. I worked those kind of places.
Well, did it affect your performance? I mean, could you tell?
I don't know. I just did it. I was asked to do 50 minutes. I do 50 minutes. That was my job.
I recently had the opportunity to see a movie that I suspect a lot of our listeners have seen, Jazz on a Summer's Day,
Mm-hmm. Which was a performance at the Newport Jazz Festival.
Oh, I was feeling no pain that day.
Really?
This is what... I was on 60 Minutes, and Harry Reasoner asked me the same thing. He says, that day when you were on Jazz on a summer's day, and you were out there in that big picture hat, and the breeze was blowing those real ostrich feathers on top of it, he says to me, were you high? And I looked at him, and I looked back at the little film they were showing me, and I says, I would say yes. That was 60 Minutes.
Well, you know what I really wanted to know was how you were wearing these great white gloves in it, these, like, I think wrist-high white gloves, and it's very sharp-looking. I don't know how many women were actually wearing those gloves back in 1958, but how did you decide to wear them? I think it almost became a trademark.
Well, I went to George Wein, who was the promoter of the whole thing, and I said, what night am I on? Because it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights. And he says to me, oh, you're on Sunday afternoon. And I said, oh, thanks a lot. You know, what am I going to wear on a Sunday afternoon? I'm not going to wear a frock to the floor, and I'm not going to wear it off the shoulder. So I got to thinking, so I lied prone, and I kind of, like, thought, what would you wear? I was due at 5 o'clock. So I wore a cocktail afternoon cocktail party dress with the black sheets and the white peplum and little glass slippers and the little white gloves and this black hat with the ostrich feathers. And that worked out apropos for the time o' day. That's a joke. O' day. Terry. Hello, Terry, are you there? Yeah, that's what happened, love.
Oh,
yep,
goodness.
That was it.
Okay. What kind of material are you singing now?
I'm doing the nostalgia bits. Old songs.
Is that because you like them? I mean,
that's because the people like them, baby. I'm out there working for the people.
Are there things that you would like to be singing that you're not?
No, anything I want to be singing, I sing it. It's my group. I pay them.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank you for even considering me. It's very nice of you to bring me forward to all the listening fans of your age, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Terry, and my best to Fresh Air. Is that what it's called?
Yep.
Let's have some fresh air, and I'm with you, babe. I'm with you, babe. Check it out.
Anita O'Day recorded in 1987. Here's her 1955 recording of A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square with Buddy Bregman's orchestra.
This heart of mine beat loud and fast, like a merry-go-round in a fair. For we were dancing cheek to cheek, and the nightingale sang in Berkeley. When dawn came stealing up all gold and blue to interrupt our rendezvous, I still remember how you smiled and said, was that a dream or was it true? Homeward step was just as light as the tap dancing feet of a stair, and like an echo far away when a nightingale sang in
Jazz Week continues tomorrow on Fresh Air. Coming up, we remember Jason Robards. He died yesterday at the age of 78. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Jason Robards died of cancer yesterday at the age of 78. One of his two Academy Awards was for his performance in the 1976 film All the President's Men, about Woodward and Bernstein, the reporters who broke the Watergate story. Robards played Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post, who was initially skeptical about publishing Woodward and Bernstein's findings.
You know, once when I was reporting, Lyndon Johnson's top guy gave me the word. They were looking for a successor for J. Edgar Hoover. I wrote it, and the day it appeared, Johnson held a press conference and appointed Hoover head of the FBI for life. When he was done, turned to his top guy, and the president said, call Ben Bradley and tell him, f*** you. Well, everybody said, you did it, Ben. You screwed up. You stuck us with Hoover forever. I screwed up, but I wasn't wrong. How much can you tell me about Deep Throat?
How much do you need to know?
You trust him?
Yeah.
I can't do the reporting for my reporters, which means I have to trust them. And I hate trusting anybody. Run that, baby.
Robards' second Academy Award was for his performance in Julia. His other films include The Battle of Cable Hogue, A Thousand Clowns, Melvin and Howard, and Magnolia. On stage, he was best known for his performances in the plays of Eugene O'Neill. Robards starred in the movie adaptation of O'Neill's Long Day's Journey into Night. I spoke with Robards in 1995 and asked why Robards and O'Neill were such a good match.
I've never really understood it. I mean, there's many people have talked about the fact that both of us were from theatrical families, that we went to sea. I was at sea for 7 years. Alcohol, but I don't think the alcohol plays a part in the creative work. You do that when you get off, you know. I don't think O'Neill wrote drunk on you know, I don't think, even though that's part of a life at one time that we both had, fathers, actors, younger brother, older brother, younger brother, that was one of the Long Day's Journey parts, mother sort of not with the family, O'Neill's through drugs and mine not there. Maybe these things add up subconsciously into something that you don't know you have. I've always found that I knew exactly what he was talking about in these plays. I didn't find them difficult, but I had good direction, I must say, from Jose Quintero, who I've done most of the almost all of the O'Neill plays with.
I want to play a clip from the film adaptation of Long Day's Journey. Made in 1962, Sidney Lumet directed it. Katharine Hepburn plays the morphine-addicted mother, Ralph Richardson, the actor father. Dean Stockwell, your younger brother, who was just diagnosed with TB in the scene we're about to hear. You play the older son, who's an alcoholic. In this scene, you had found out earlier in the day that your younger brother has tuberculosis. The family's been squabbling and delusional as usual all day.
Yeah.
So you've walked out to go drinking. In this scene, you've just returned. You're very drunk, and you're saying things to your brother that you wouldn't say if you were sober.
I want to warn you against me. Mama and Papa are right. I've been a rotten, bad influence. But worst of all is, I did it on purpose.
I don't want to hear
it. Next kid. You listen. I did it on purpose to make a bum out of you. Or part of me did, a big part. The part that's been dead so long that hates life. My putting you wise so you'd learn from my mistake. Ah. Well, I believe that myself at times, but it's a fake. Made my mistakes look good. Made getting drunk romantic. Made whores fascinating vampires instead of poor stupid disease slobs they really are. Made fun of work as a sucker's game. I never wanted you succeed and make me look even worse by comparison. Wanted you to fail. Always jealous of you. Mama's baby, Papa's pet. And it was your being born that started Mama on dope. I know that's not your fault, but all the same, God damn you! I can't help hating your guts!
In the scene that we just heard, the character is drunk. What kind of...
Well, he's not, you see, it's beyond drunk, you know what I mean. It's in vino veritas, I guess. He's not, you know, sometimes you get drunk and you're not drunk. You're sharper than ever.
But still, he has been drinking a lot, and I'm wondering how you wanted to play this character drunk. I mean, you could play drunk very broadly. You could play it so that one barely notices.
I just go with the word. Listen, those words are so strong, and that scene is so strongly written, you can't even slur in it. Now, the first part of that scene, he's trying to avoid getting into this part of it, which is the end of it. The first part of it, he tells about going into town and going to a hooker shop or whatever they call it, and he does that in a strangely comical sort of way and pretends to be drunker than he is. And then the truths start to start coming out. And the more truthful the scene gets, the more sober and devastating he is.
Jason Robards, recorded in 1995. He died of cancer yesterday at the age of 78. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer this week is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Here's Jason Robards in the 1965 film, A Thousand Clowns.
Yes, sir, we've decided. No, sir, we won't hide it. Yes, sir, that's my baby now. Oh, by the way, hey, by the way, when we somebody will say, yes, sir.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Everyday Genius by Michael J. Gelb, available in paperback. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jazz Week continues with pianist Marion McPartland, saxophonist James Moody, and singer Annie Ross, formerly of Lambert Hendricks and Ross. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.